Former President Donald Trump was indicted today for trying to overturn his loss to Joe Biden.
We have to win in November, or we're not going to have Pennsylvania. They'll change the name. They're going to change the name of Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvanians have a unique role with democracy and freedom. We have seen Pennsylvanians rise up at the ballot box.
The work of making this world resemble one that you would prefer to live in is a lunch pail job.
Hi, welcome to the Keystone Reckoning Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse White, and we have a special guest today, Alexandra Hunt, who is running for Congress in the PA 3rd, which is currently represented by Dwight Evans. Alexandra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Great. So the first thing I always do with candidates is give me 30 seconds about yourself. You may need a minute, so go ahead.
So let me think quickly. I am a public health researcher, a girls soccer coach, a former stripper. I've worked as a server. I'm challenging Dwight Evans from the left. So that kind of gives my political views. My parents are both teachers. I have a twin brother. We have a very unique backstory that would take a little bit longer to tell. I am a huge dog lover, and that's me.
Cool. How many dogs do you have?
I have one. I used to have two, but my soul dog died this past summer.
I'm in the same situation. My soul dog died. I've never heard it put that way. She died about 2 years ago. So yeah, I know. I could see her ashes and her little collar from where I'm sitting in my office. So, what's your dog's name that you have now? What's their name?
Coda with a T.
You can usually tell a lot about people by the way they name their dog. So yeah, that's a unique name, which is cool.
He's named after La Cota.
Got it. Okay. So you, like you said, you have a very unique backstory, and we're going to, I'd like to get into little bits and pieces. I am not going to lead with the fact that you're a former stripper, because I have a feeling that my question is more of a process question about that. Are you getting tired, I'm sure, of that being the first question you're asked by everybody?
No, I'm not tired of it being, I know that it draws in attention, and sex work and advocacy for sex workers is something that we should be having conversations about. So I'm very happy to talk about it. I also like to talk about other things. So just having a well-rounded conversation is always something I enjoy.
Excellent. And that's what we're going to do. So I have to say, you have the distinction of being the first candidate I ever found via TikTok. And I am a 43-year-old, cis white male. I'm not TikTok's prime demographic. I do not broadcast on TikTok because I know how ridiculous it would look. But I always, working in social media, I always try to, learn different things. And I found you on there, and I was fascinated. And right before we went live, I was just watching some of your most recent ones, and they're hilarious. Is that your primary method right now of kind of reaching out to people? And tell me a little bit about your process with that.
Yeah. So, you're uncovering something that we've been trying to keep on the DL, which is okay. It's all right. It's about time it came out. But, TikTok is a very powerful tool. And it's really powerful to reach a lot of young people and young people that we need engaged in politics, and to speak to them about policy points and platform and personal issues and ways that they can relate. So when we first launch, we have a Facebook, we have a Twitter, an Instagram, and a TikTok. And I think there might be an unused YouTube channel too. But Twitter is so saturated with politicians and candidates, and it's hard to yell over everyone. You can't be heard. So we were like, we're kind of doing well on TikTok, and because I am a young candidate, I might do well on TikTok. We might back away from Twitter a little bit and see if we can thrive in this other environment. You can come in. That was why we chose to go to TikTok.
Well, it's interesting. So for context for our listeners, and it's at Alexandra Hunt for Congress, you have 57,500 followers, which is pretty good, especially given the fact that on TikTok, you, unlike most platforms, you can't do political advertising. So this is all, that's all organic, right?
It's all organic.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And it looks like you post, I don't know, every day, every other day. Is it kind of just, you know, is there a method to your madness, or is it just kind of like, I see an article, it pissed me off, I'm going to just throw something up about it?
The method to, I've had a lot of people ask me for strategy tips, and mm-hmm. I am very lacking. I can just tell you what we do, right. What I do. And it's basically, I try to spend 5 minutes going, just flipping through, listening for sounds, popular sounds, trending sounds, and see what can I use that to pull in something about our platform or something about our story. I know that TikTok really likes story time. And so I do try to sometimes find longer sounds so I can give a personal story and then explain how that ties into policy points. That's really the method that, and sometimes it goes off really well, and sometimes it just gets a couple of views.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking some of, I mean, well, when you say a couple, I mean, most of your, the lowest one I'm seeing on here is like 5,000. So it's not nothing. And so a couple more questions about that, because again, this platform stuff, you know, I work with a lot of different clients all over the country. And, you know, the big challenge is, how do you talk to voters? Because voters say, no one ever talks to me. But then no matter how you try to talk to them, they get all pissed off. Right? Don't email me. Don't text me. Don't call me. Don't show up at my door and stay off my fucking social media. So where's the middle? You know, how do you hit people? And it looks like, you know, you may have found a way to kind of break through some of that in a way, quite frankly, that most candidates wouldn't have the guts to do, because your stuff isn't fake. It's real. It's authentic.
Right. And it does take guts there with some of the most vulnerable posts that I've done. There is always this moment, like right before I go to post it, of just like, whew, my heart rate is increasing right now, and I'm just going to post it, turn it off, and not look, and you know, whatever comes from that, I'm going to take a breather and not check it. But I think it is a really good way to connect, and that's what people, especially young people, have been looking for. They're happy to talk about student debt cancellation, but they want to know, how does this impact you? And can I tell you how this impacts me? And then kind of get into the conversation coming from a personal place, because policy is personal. And the same thing I don't know it, because I can't take TikTok and know who follows us, who's in Philly, who's in the district. And so that makes it hard. So I don't know if I'm reaching voters. It, based on some comments, it sounds like we have found that algorithm or whatnot. And we do use the hashtag Philly to try to get as close to home as possible. But I think people just want to be able to connect and know that you're going to listen and fight for the issues from a place of understanding, and not just a place of, this looks good on my campaign.
Yeah. Well, you answered my next question, which is, you know, with all those followers, are you able to see where they're coming from? And, you know, so the answer being no, I guess the next question is then, is there a concern? So I'll put it this way. If I were managing your opponent's campaign, which I'm not, I would say, if nothing else to make them feel better, I'd say, they're not hitting the people that are going to actually come out and vote. Right. Don't worry about this TikTok stuff. It's not going to hit with their, you know, our people. How much of a concern is that for you? And I'm not talking about necessarily location. I'm talking about demographics. I mean, we all want younger people to come out and vote, but historically getting them to do it has been extremely difficult, especially in a primary. So how do you reconcile that?
As I said, I don't know if these are voters, but I do know that these are young people I want involved in politics. So while they might not be able to vote for me, they can volunteer for our campaign. And so then we reach voters with our message through other means. And some people, when we're knocking on doors, I've already heard of her. I've seen the TikToks, we're on board, or they, you know, reach out through other means of supporting our campaign through fundraisers or in-person forums or stuff like that. I mean, not in-person, Zoom, but things that are tied into the district and we know that voters are showing up to, but they found about us on TikTok.
Last TikTok question, because I'm just fascinated by this, is how has it driven your fundraising?
We had a big boost from TikTok over the summer, and I was shocked. Everyone was shocked.
I'm not.
Really?
No, I mean, it makes total sense. I mean, you if I'm just, you know, someone that cares about these issues and I see you and I see you're kind of breaking the mold and doing unique things, you know, I'm gonna be like, oh yeah, I'm going to throw a few bucks, you know, to try. And I like right on your thing there, it says your $10 helps, right? Yeah. You're not aiming huge. You're being realistic. So I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off about how it's helping your fundraising.
Yeah, it is helping our fundraising. It's not the bread and butter of it. That's mm-hmm. through more traditional methods. But it's definitely helped and just been kind of a shock that we've been able to fundraise on TikTok. And it's hard because you can't do any advertisements. And if you directly ask for a donation, I think the algorithm suppresses that. Yeah. So you have to find creative ways to be like, hey, check out what I'm asking for on the profile and kind of point people in that direction and hope that they land there by giving a contribution.
Cool. I have two more process questions, then we're going to jump into policy because that's what I really care about. I know that's what you really care about too. So in terms of fundraising, I looked, Dwight has raised at the end of the year, his cash on hand was about $350,000. I'm sure he'll be able to raise more as needed. Where, I mean, do you feel as though, you know, what have you done so far in terms of fundraising? And I didn't have a chance to pull your filing, but, and do you feel as though you'll have at least the bare minimum resources to compete, you know, with someone who's going to, you know, for whom money really won't be much of a problem?
So, I feel like my opponent's war chest is digging his own grave. Because of where he goes to get his money from. It's been brought up by other sources besides myself. It's definitely been brought up by our campaign about, you know, why is he taking money from private prisons? Why is he taking money from oil companies? Why is he taking money from weapons manufacturers when these are crises that are impacting the district? So I think that while he might be out raising us, I think the way that he's going about it is pretty damning. As for, are we going to be able to compete? Yes. This last quarter, we raised 103 in the quarter. He raised 151 in the quarter. We are on his tail. We are there. And all of us are very competitive and ready to go and ready to find ways through small dollar fundraising and connection and networking of how can we actually outraise him when we're against a corporate backed politician.
So redistricting, it's, you know, it's going back and forth, and it looks as though the state Supreme Court is going to be the final arbiter of the lines, which is great for Democrats in general. What are your concerns specifically about, is that going to make much of an impact in the district or?
Not for us. I was looking at maps that Republicans are putting out and Democrats were putting out and nobody cares about PA3. It's not being touched too much. We might get a little bit more on the south end. Maybe just like a little corner added to it, but it's really not changing the lines. The concern was how close we were getting to needing to collect petition signatures. And that was causing a lot of angst. But with the new deadline being, I think, the 18th, that's past the petition deadline. So they're going to move the primary.
Right. Right. Yeah, I saw House Republicans, State House Republicans, have, you know, they've talked about this insane idea of doing, you know, 17 at-large. You know, and it's, I know Seth Grove, it's insane.
It's a threat. They're just trying to spook people, and it's stupid. The PAGOP, I've got no time for.
And that is the luxury of running in a, you know, an ultra progressive district, which is just awesome. You know, when I was in the state house, I represented a swing district that now I couldn't get elected to save my life, partially because my views have gone to the left. The district has gone hard right. And, you know, they voted for Trump and the whole bit. And, you know, it is one of the things that always blew my mind was just what a different daily existence my colleagues had that represented Philly and other, you know, really strong blue districts. And it's something I always kind of like craved because it just, it gives you so much more freedom to do things.
So I know that you want to talk about my race and PA3, mm-hmm. but I'm actually very curious about your district. And sure. Because what we're seeing a polarization of the country, and it's happening in Pennsylvania and at home, and Democrats really speak to urban areas. That's where they target, that's where their strongholds are, and that's what they're trying to protect is that big city, Pittsburgh, Philly in our state, and then spreading out from there, but into the more rural areas, they've kind of accepted that it's red. And I think that part of it is because no Democratic politician is going into these rural areas and speaking to the needs of these people, but red Republicans are. They're saying, and they're also speaking to the fears of these people. So I just want to hear about more about that shift. You said they've shifted further to the right. They've shifted towards voting for Trump. What is it that they are needing that they're getting from Republicans?
That is a fantastic question. And to clarify, the district that I was referring to was when I lived in southwestern PA. So it was like, it was the just south of Pittsburgh, all, you know, between like, it was Washington County. So it was right below Allegheny, right above Greene. So it was like down the southwest corner. And what switched it there was, and the thing that bounced me out of office was that's where all the fracking started. Right at the very, we're going back to like 03, 04. I was in office from 06 to 14. And what happened was they came in and, you know, we always said that fracking was its own political party. So not only did the Republicans just fell in line, but they co-opted most of the Democrats. You know, my state senator fell in with them and all these, you know, everybody. And there was this idea outside of the energy industry stuff that you had to be this southwestern PA Democrat. You know, you had to be pro-gun and pro-life in order to even have a seat at the table. Yeah. And, you know, I kind of fell into that when I started. You know, I was always pro-choice and you know, that wasn't going to change. But, you know, I fell into the gun stuff a little bit. And it was interesting because it was my colleagues from Philly. I was on the House Judiciary Committee. And so we dealt with a lot of gun legislation. And I saw that, you know, the gun issue was just a totally different issue.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about guns in southwestern PA are not the same as guns in Philly, obviously. And I felt like the Democrats as a whole, you know, this is like when Rendell was governor and everything, they were demonizing gun owners, but they were demonizing gun. What they were really demonizing was gun violence, which, you know, is not a bad thing, but they didn't know enough to make, they showed a disdain for people who could not possibly identify with the perpetrators of gun violence in urban areas. And they were offended that the comparison was being made, that they were being lumped in with that. You know, we were talking about the quote responsible gun owner, which they actually do exist. You know, I've spoken to a bunch of sportsmen's clubs and stuff like that. And, you know, they don't all fit the profile. Some of them do, but for the most part, you know, and folks like that that had been like union members and, you know, blue collar workers that were Democrats, you know, they started getting demonized and they started wandering away from the party. And I'm not going to lie. I think there was a healthy dose of racism whenever Obama was elected. I think that definitely played into it. And then on top of all of that, the Republicans got smart. And like you said, they learned how to play on those fears. They learned how to say, hey, they're looking, these East Coast elites are looking down their nose at you. They don't share your values. And they learned, you know, they learned how to speak to them. And it's one of the reasons I actually started the Keystone Reckoning Project was because in Pennsylvania specifically, I think Democrats' messaging as a whole, especially in legislative campaigns, just sucks. There's just kind of no nice way to say it. And, you know, it's cookie cutter. It's the same thing over and over and over again. And, you know, I want to basically use this pack as a testing ground to show that, no, if you talk to people like grownups about real issues they actually care about, they don't care if it's a progressive or a conservative, you know, take. It's a take that matters to them. And to speak to them in an intelligent way and to kind of, you know, take a page out of the Republicans' playbook when necessary to kind of beat them at their own game. So that was a bit of a long-winded answer, but it was a great question. So, all right, let's get back to you because that's what people want to hear. All right, so let's get off of process for a minute because we've done enough of that. Let's talk policy. So you've got, you know, the progressive smorgasbord of wonderful policies. What's your, you know, in a perfect world, you walk into Congress day one, you can make any one thing happen. What's it going to be?
I tell this to everyone, that our number one issue has to be climate action, because we can fight all we want about reproductive rights and gun ownership and whatnot, but if we don't have a planet to live on, it's all moot. So we have to address the climate crisis. And the Green New Deal is a start. There's been drops in the bucket, but there isn't enough legislation yet to say just one thing. It's just that we got to check that box now.
How do you think, what do you think the way forward is when you're dealing with these quote conservative Democrats? And, you know, obviously you've got the Joe Manchins at the far end of the spectrum in the Senate, but, you know, one of the challenges on climate issues especially is this idea that it's, you know, it's hurting jobs and American energy independence and all that kind of stuff. Which we know to be bullshit, right? Yeah. But it's unfortunately kind of congealed as a conventional wisdom with so many, you know, conservative Dems. And along the lines of what we just talked about how do you talk about these issues without demonizing folks? What's the strategy there? How would you talk to a colleague? How would you, obviously as a member of Congress, you're going to have a voice and a platform. How would you do that messaging?
It's tough because I have fielded phone calls from different members of the U.S. House, and they are not kind to progressives. They are not kind to the left wing voice. And while environment is a big issue, the biggest problem they have with me is the platform I have on criminal justice reform. And so it makes it very difficult when two people are trying to speak past each other.
Let me stop you there, Frank, because that's a really interesting thing. So you've gotten calls from sitting members. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to ask you to name who they are. It'd be awesome if you did, but I can fully respect that. But that what has been, if they really disagree with you, what has been the crux of the call? Is it like, hey, we want to get you out of the race? We want to get you to say thing, you know, we want to, yeah. Is it a fishing expedition? What's that all about?
It's to berate me for running and for having the views that I have.
That's wild. that these are sitting members of Congress that, you know, that would engage in such a petty, like, they literally have nothing better to do than to call and bitch you out for running for office.
Right. And they're not in my district. Like, it's not my opponent. he's ignoring me.
I mean, I'm sure these are emissaries or whatever, but that's wild. I mean, so what do you say to that? I mean, how long do these conversations typically last?
I'm not someone who is unopinionated and who right. doesn't like to argue. So I'll engage with it for a little bit and then I'll say, okay, you know, I get it. You called me. You don't want me running for office. I have things to do. I'm going to keep working. and then we go our separate ways.
What's the nastiest thing that someone said to you?
Oh, I mean, I'm from people who hear.
What's the nastiest thing that like a thing that a sitting member of Congress said to you that you were like, what the fuck was that?
I'm trying to remember, but it was less directed at me personally and more directed at progressives and the left. Just that we were jokes and that all we do is tweet and that we're inflammatory and da da da. To me, the most disgusting thing was not directed at my positions, but at a story that one representative told about wanting to throw a 16-year-old girl in prison forever. Why he felt validated in saying that. That to me is disgusting. That's inhumane. That's a 16-year-old life. That's a young person. And people make mistakes and we have to get to a place of being able to forgive people so that they can move past those mistakes, because there's so much more to a person than that one mistake that they made. So that was the most disgusting thing.
So give us your platform on criminal justice reform that apparently has everybody so worked up. Like what is this insane radical proposal platform that you have?
Well, before I was running for office, I was a community organizer for Mass Liberation. And so I am, as a survivor of violence, I believe in prison abolition and I believe in restorative justice. I don't think that putting people in cages for any amount of time brings back results of rehabilitation. And so I identify as a prison abolitionist, and that really ruffles feathers.
So what does that look like then? If a convicted murderer, convicted rapist, convicted child molester, what happens to them? Explain how that works.
I think that when I get into these conversations, we always go to the most violent, most extreme case. And so I'm a survivor of sexual assault. And what my form of justice would be, and this is only for me, is to have the perpetrator understand, because it was someone I knew and someone that I thought would never do that. Have him understand the pain that it caused, the consequences that I faced down the line from trying to overcome this trauma, and to never do that again. And for him to figure out why he engaged in that sort of behavior, and to fix that part of him. That's what I want. Because now the last I heard, he has a kid. He has a partner. And so for me to come in and to take him, to remove him from that environment and to want to put him in a cage, I could be damning that child for a similar future. I don't know his backstory, but I think that when we react to that crime and punish it, we miss out on the backstory of how did you get here? what happened? Because if you've ever looked into the stories of people who are on death row, they've done really messed up things, but they've had really messed up things done to them. And nobody stepped in. Nobody said this, you know, this isn't how we should be treating people. And so we just perpetuate trauma and pain and violence. So what does it look like? You start with nonviolent crimes. Never should be putting those people in prison. If it's drugs, get them rehab, community help. I don't know why they have to go to prison. If it's sex work, absolutely not. Why do they have to be in prison? They're trying to live. Traffic offenses. I don't know what else sends people to prison, but it seems like everything. And it's all blue collar crime. It's not white collar crime. They're not in prison. And that's something that is often missed in discussion, is that if you're a person of color, you're poor, or you're both, you're targeted for prison. And they try to find a way to snatch you up. And it's just predatory. And it's not, it has nothing to do with justice. And people who are elderly, they've shown that by the time they're over the age of, I don't know, 70, 65, that they're so unlikely to commit a violent crime. It's like less than 1%. Why are they in prison where they can't get medical care, proper medical care?
Yeah. So that's all fascinating. To put it in context, yeah, I practiced law for 13 years, so I've worked in the system, and you're right. The injustices are there if you look at it. It's not hard to find. I guess my question is, because that's such a, you know, it's such a, not even controversial, it's just such a out-of-the-box position for a political candidate to have, that I feel as though you probably have to do a lot of explaining as to what it means. And, you know, and for example, I mean, I've never talked to a candidate who's a prison abolitionist before, so I'm just fascinated, right? So I guess like the question would be, so for example, and I, you know, I get everybody goes immediately to the most violent crimes because those are the one, you know, I get the nonviolent offenses, the drug offenses, that all I understand. But like, if we had somebody that was a violent criminal that had committed a sexual assault or something like that. I understand that we don't have prison, but is there some sort of like intermediate custody or something, you know, in terms of, are their freedoms restricted while they're undergoing these, you know, the day they pull the guy off the street, you know, I mean, are they putting him in a cell until it's all figured out while
No, that came out of the time of slavery. That idea of that's how prison was born. Is that we're going to hold on to these people while they await trial, and figure out what their punishment is, and then imprisonment became the punishment, and it became the universal punishment for all crime. So what do we do with perpetrators of violent crime? Well, these are people who have fallen through the cracks. Usually there are people who have severe mental illness. Who commit crimes with no remorse and really no rhyme or reason. And so for those people, they need a lot of mental health treatment and care, and probably a facility. For people who do other sorts of crimes without that mental handicap, it's usually fallen through the cracks, and they need to be in some form reparented. They have to have a scaffold built for them where it's not so hard to live and survive. And they can focus on working out the trauma that got them to that place. So right now I'm thinking of a friend of mine who is, he was imprisoned as a teenager. I think he spent something like 20 years in there, most of it in solitary. And the second he got out, he went back to fighting for the rest of his brothers. And he's a phenomenal man. And we missed out on 20 years of him because when he was a teenager, he got caught up with what was going on at the corner. I think that if we had had a system where housing was not a concern, healthcare wasn't a concern, a job wasn't a concern, and it was more just about learning how to live in this society and provide for yourself and become an adult, we could have seen him back 3 years, 2 years, however, you know, much, much sooner, because all he really needed was a job. He was worried about what his income was going to be when he turned 18.
Wow. Okay. It's definitely something, you know, you've thought about a lot, and it's something I'm definitely intend to do some research on after we're done here, because it's just a fascinating topic. What I want to do is take a kind of like a false non-break, because I'm going to break this up into two episodes for podcast purposes. So I'm going to do a fake closing, and then we're just going to start the second episode. So this is the end of part one with Alexandra Hunt running in PA03. And Alexandra, give everybody your information if they want to donate or learn more about you.
Yes, please. We're doing 100% grassroots fundraising, so every dollar really counts and is appreciated. You can find our website at huntforcongress.com. Spell everything out. Alexandra Hunt for Congress is our Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And then Twitter is @Hunt4Congress.
Awesome. All right, Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, that's it then. We've saved people the trouble of voting. What's next?
Our point is that it's...
I understood the point. We're going to South Carolina to set up Illinois. When I ask what's next, it means I'm ready to move on to other things. So, what's next?
We're done.
Fantastic.